Meaningful Moments with Aya.
Dublin accuses London of undermining European Union efforts to resolve the row over the Northern Ireland Protocol, warning that patience in Brussels is wearing thin. Austria's former Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg is sworn in as the country's new Chancellor following the resignation of Sebastian Kurz over corruption allegations. And five Indian soldiers are killed in an attack in Kashmir as tensions run high in the disputed region amid a spate of civilian killings. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Dublin accuses London of undermining European Union efforts to resolve the row over the Northern Ireland Protocol, warning that patience in Brussels is wearing thin. The Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney made the remarks, noting that Britain has dismissed the bloc's proposals even before they are published. This comes as the European Commission is set to publish new proposals later this week to smooth trade between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. The protocol is a key part of the Brexit deal and is designed to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland. However, the UK government has urged the bloc to rewrite the deal, a request flatly rejected by Brussels. British police say that they are taking no further action after conducting a review of evidence relating to sex crime allegations against Queen Elizabeth's son, Prince Andrew. In a statement, police concluded that the claims are not sufficient to warrant any further investigation. In August, London's police chief said that detectives would look at the allegations for a third time after Virginia Giuffre filed a U.S. lawsuit. She accused the Duke of York of abusing her around two decades ago, along with late U.S. financier Jeffrey Epstein. Last week, Andrew's lawyers were given permission to examine a confidential settlement between Epstein and Giuffre in 2009. The agreement is believed to release the prince from all liability in the case. Austria's former Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg is sworn in as the country's new Chancellor following the resignation of Sebastian Kurz over corruption allegations. Austrian President Alexander van der Bellen formally swore in Schallenberg in a televised ceremony. The 52-year-old diplomat pledged to work closely with Kurz. The former Chancellor stepped down on Saturday after prosecutors began investigating him and his close team members. Accused of using government money between 2016 and 18 to ensure positive media coverage. Kurz has denied the allegations. Let's get some more details behind the story. Homa Leski is a correspondent joining us from Vienna. Homa, thanks for joining us. So tell us more about this, if there are any additional details, and more curious about how Sebastian Kurz ranked amongst the public there and what public reaction there is to the story there.
Yes, Kaba, hello. Now, let's just give you some more details about the developments today. Of course, as you said there, Austria has a new chancellor now, the former foreign minister, Alexander Schallenberg, and he is considered to be a close confidant of Mr. Kurz and a close ally of Mr. Kurz. And indeed, in his first address and statement to the nation, he said that he believes the allegations against Mr. Kurz are wrong, and that he's convinced that they're going to be proven false, and he also said that he will, quote, work closely with Mr. Kurz. We know, of course, that Sebastian Kurz will remain the leader of his centre-right People's Party and will remain active in Parliament, and that has led the opposition parties and basically the general population to assume that although temporarily he has lost power as Chancellor, he will be behind the scenes pulling the strings. But Mr. Kurz, in response to this criticism today, in a written statement, said that he is not, I'm quoting, a shadow chancellor, and that he believes that Mr. Schallenberg is a very good option to bring the coalition closer together. He means, of course, the coalition that his People's Party, the OVP, has had with the Greens. But we have to see if this coalition is going to hold, because some parts of the opposition were saying that with Kurz still behind the scenes, basically, the opposition seeing Mr. Schallenberg as a, quote, puppet, they were saying that maybe the coalition would not be as stable as analysts are hoping, but the Green Party leader, who's also vice president, had a meeting with Mr. Schallenberg yesterday, and he said that it was a positive meeting and that he believes that this coalition can hold until the next regular elections in 2024. And that is, of course, the time to tell if that is actually going to happen. So as for now, when you're asking about the reactions and the public opinion on this, when I was reading different parts of the media about this, and some are saying that the broad support that Mr. Kurz has enjoyed among the public, although it has been affected by these allegations against him, that however, this does not mean that he has lost the general public support, especially when it comes to the support that he received based on hardline policies that he pursued, for instance, against the issue of immigration. And also, this is a criticism that Mr. Schallenberg himself is facing, because he's now seen as a hardliner when it comes to the refugee crisis, for instance, most recently when it came to the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. He said that he was against Austria accepting any Afghan refugees. He was also criticized for raising the Israeli flag, for instance, on the foreign ministry building when there were clashes taking place between Israelis and Palestinians. So he is seen as following the same policy, hardline policy, as Sebastian Kurz, and the opposition believes that there's not going to be a change, that Mr. Kurz will mainly be behind this puppet figure or the figurehead, Mr. Kurz himself rejecting this, saying that he believes this is going to create a new chapter when it comes to cooperation between the coalition partners, something that, as for now, has also been confirmed by the Green Party.
Great, thank you so much for that. Homolowski there from Vienna. Okay, moving on with the news. Iran's parliament speaker says any agreements on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, must remove U.S. sanctions. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf made the call in a meeting with the Swiss National Council President Andreas Avi in Tehran. Ghalibaf said the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden persists on his predecessor's sanctions policy against Tehran. He noted that Washington must take the first step and fulfill its commitments under the JCPOA if it expects Tehran to do the same. The former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Iran. JCPOA revival talks remain stalled over what Tehran deems as excessive demands from the United States and the European signatories to the deal. Five soldiers have been killed by suspected militants in Indian-controlled Kashmir, as tensions run high in the disputed region amid a spate of civilian killings. An army spokesman said the troopers were shot dead while on a search operation. The shootings occurred near the line of control that separates the region from the Pakistani-administered side. That's a day after the Indian military detained nearly 500 residents following targeted killings of seven civilians, including two teachers. A group calling itself the Resistance Front has claimed responsibility. Tensions have been heightened in the Muslim-majority region since New Delhi revoked its semi-autonomy status and brought it under direct rule in 2019. New Delhi and Islamabad both claimed Kashmir in its entirety and fought two wars on the region since their independence in 1947. The United States says it has held, quote, candid and professional talks with the Taliban delegation in Qatar. The U.S. State Department said the two sides discussed security and terrorism, as well as human rights in Afghanistan, among other issues. The department added, however, that Washington will judge the Taliban on the basis of their actions, not words. According to the Afghan acting foreign minister, representatives from the two countries also talked about opening a new page in bilateral relations. Amir Khan Muttaqi said the Taliban delegation urged the U.S. to lift the ban on the country's central bank reserves. The group rose back to power in Afghanistan in August, almost two decades after it was ousted in a U.S.-led invasion. The Taliban takeover happened amid a hasty withdrawal of foreign forces from the war-torn country. On Friday, dozens of people were killed and scores more wounded in a bomb blast targeting a Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Iranian officials were quick to condemn the attack, urging the Taliban to do what they can to establish peace and security in Afghanistan.
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir Group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they try to disrupt Iraq and Syria and try to cause a major stabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
Well, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he has called on Afghan officials to bring the perpetrators of this attack to justice. In the meantime, the Taliban has condemned the attack as heinous, vowing to find and to punish the perpetrators.
In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind the Friday terrorist attack targeting worshippers at a packed Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The bitter, tragic incident involving a blast at the mosque of Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the deaths of a large number of faithful worshippers, saddened us. Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take necessary measures to prevent a recurrence of such tragedies. In fact, Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for several attacks in Afghanistan in recent weeks. This has put the Taliban under pressure because the newly formed rule vowed to provide safety for Afghans when it took power in August. Therefore, the Taliban has vowed to find and punish the perpetrators. They also have destroyed a cell belonging to Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, recently. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai had once said in an interview that the U.S. is colluding with Daesh in Afghanistan and allowing the Takfiris to flourish in the conflict-stricken country. In addition, many U.S. officials have confessed to Washington being responsible for Daesh's creation. Now that this unholy child of Washington's flawed policies in the Middle East is causing trouble, it's likely that we are going to see a major confrontation between Daesh and the Taliban in the near future.
Syrians have rallied in the occupied Golan Heights to protest against Israel's settlement construction on their land. Protesters marched through the town of Mas'ada. Earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that he plans to establish two new settlements in the occupied Golan Heights. He said the regime aims at doubling the number of Israeli settlers in the area. Parts of the Golan Heights have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. Although the UN and the rest of the international community recognize Syria's sovereignty over the region. Vote counting is underway for Sunday's early parliamentary elections in Iraq. The Electoral Commission has put the voter turnout at 41%. That is lower than the last election that was held in the year 2018. Nearly 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots for the 329-seat legislature. Around 3,500 candidates are in the fray. This is Iraq's fifth parliamentary election since the ouster of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. Sunday's vote was called 1 year earlier than it was scheduled in response to the 2019 street protests over economic woes and high-level corruption. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Melbourne psychologist Chris Cheer says the coronavirus pandemic's effect has been akin to grief, and acceptance of it is hard to reach. We now present you an article written by Calla Walquist under the heading, Complex and Quite Ambiguous Loss, What COVID Has Done to Our Mental Health. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. After 18 months, psychologist Chris Cheers has begun to understand emotional responses to the global COVID pandemic as a kind of grief. It's a collective grief experienced by the whole world at once, but also deeply personal. Our losses are not the same, just as our experiences have not been the same. Some have lost loved ones from COVID and in other ways, and have been unable to attend funerals. Some have experienced a loss of health through long COVID, or a long-term loss of income or loss of work. The impact of both the virus and the restrictions have been disproportionate, affecting marginalized communities more than others. Psychologist Chris Cheers says it is a complex and quite ambiguous loss, which makes it difficult to process, adding, "When the losses are so ambiguous and complex, it's really difficult to reach that place of acceptance, so we just kind of get stuck in the grief and stuck in the distress. The usual support networks that scaffold us in grief have also gone. In states with lockdowns in place, we are not allowed to gather and seek comfort from each other, and even when we are able to reach out, those who might usually offer support are grieving their own losses." Psychologists Chris Cheers says, "People's capacity to support each other, I think it's starting to diminish. When Australia first went into lockdown in March of 2020, Prime Minister Scott Morrison warned the pandemic could last 6 months. He was wrong, of course. The pandemic is still going, and the mental and physical effects of living under it have accumulated." Psychologist Chris Cheers added, "In terms of lockdown's impact on mental health and on the brain, this doesn't get easier, this gets harder." He added, "The impacts of stress and the impacts of all the loss that lockdowns bring are cumulative. that cumulative stress moves people away from the hope. Chris added, during Melbourne's 112-day lockdown last year, there was a sense of collective purpose that provided some meaning behind the restrictions. We were locking down to save elderly people, to save our community. We were locking down one last time. Data from the Medicare benefits schedule shows a surge in demand for services during Melbourne's second wave of lockdown last year, which was not matched in other states. Chris Chair says this year, with the Delta variant of the coronavirus racing against the vaccine rollout and winning, that sense of purpose has fractured to be replaced by a sense of frustration and anger. He says, when that doesn't shift, it then moves to that hopelessness or apathy, which I'm seeing more and more in many clients now. Wait list has never been longer. The decision to double the number of Medicare subsidized psychology appointments from 5 to 10 was welcome news for clients, but the number of psychologists has not changed. Even with a Medicare rebate, those booking a private psychologist have to be able to pay the gap. Doubling the number of sessions does not make it more accessible. The pivot to telehealth has also required a rapid reskilling. Chris Cheers has been conducting one-on-one therapy via Zoom in his spare room in Melbourne for the past 18 months, replacing years of practice in reading body language with a new skill of making eye contact through a webcam. He says, if you make eye contact with someone on video, it doesn't feel like eye contact because you're looking at them on the screen and not on the camera. He added, to make eye contact, I have to make up with the camera. So I feel like I'm doing therapy with a green light at the moment. And psychologists are also living in a pandemic, living through the same lockdowns and restrictions as their clients. Chris Cheer says it gives them a pathway to understanding and empathy, but it has also wrung them dry. He says, I think a lot of psychologists would join me in saying that right now we're exhausted, but we're all incredibly needed. He added, our wait lists are long, our clients are in need, and that's a very challenging place to be, to know that there is so much support that's needed that you can offer at the same time when your capacity to support is depleted. According to a new World Health Organization survey, the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted or halted critical mental health services in 93% of countries worldwide, while the demand for mental health is increasing. The survey of 130 countries provides the first global data showing the devastating impact of COVID-19 on access to mental health services and underscores the urgent need for increased funding. The survey was published ahead of World Health Organization's big event for mental health, a global online advocacy event on 10th of October this year that will bring together world leaders, celebrities and advocates to call for increased mental health investments in the wake of COVID-19. The World Health Organization, WHO, has previously highlighted the chronic underfunding of mental health. Prior to the pandemic, countries were spending less than 2% of their national health budgets on mental health, and struggling to meet their population's needs. And the pandemic is increasing demand for mental health services. Bereavement, isolation, loss of income, and fear are all triggering mental health conditions or exacerbating existing ones. Many people may be facing increased levels of alcohol and drug use, insomnia, and anxiety. Meanwhile, COVID-19 itself can lead to neurological and mental complications, such as delirium, agitation, and stroke. People with pre-existing mental, neurological, and/or substance abuse disorders are also more vulnerable to SARS-CoV-2 infection. They may stand a high risk of severe outcomes and even death. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, said, "Good mental health is absolutely fundamental to overall health and well-being," adding, "COVID-19 has interrupted essential mental health services around the world, just when they're needed most. World leaders must move fast and decisively to invest more in life-saving mental health programs during the pandemic and beyond." The survey evaluates how the provision of mental, neurological, and substance abuse services has changed due to COVID-19, the types of services that have been disrupted, and how countries are adapting to overcome these challenges. Countries reported widespread disruption of many kinds of critical mental health services. Over 60% reported disruptions to mental health services for vulnerable people, including children and adolescents, 72%, older adults, 70%, and women requiring antenatal and postnatal services, 61%. 67% saw disruptions to counseling and psychotherapy, 65% to critical harm reduction services, and 45% to opioid agonist maintenance treatment for opioid dependence. More than a third, or 35%, reported disruptions to emergency interventions, including those for people experiencing prolonged seizures, severe substance use withdrawal syndromes, and delirium, often a sign of serious underlying medical condition. 30% reported disruptions to access for medications for mental, neurological, and substance use disorders. Around three-quarters reported at least partial disruptions to school and workplace mental health services, that is 78% and 75% respectively.
Economic divide.
It is a known fact that Israel has influence in many industries in the world, in particular when it comes to the financial world. But to what extent does it have influence in that industry? Hi, I'm Kavit Hafley. This edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Israeli control in financial sectors like payment systems, and in particular, its penetration in the U.S. financial system. Coming up in today's program, Israeli influence over the United States. Does it overlap into U.S.'s financial system, like the Fed or Wall Street? We'll take a close look at Fortune 500 companies like J.P. Morgan Chase. How did it and others like it become the largest banks in the U.S.? Then we're going to take a look at a recent deal that occurred between PayPal and the ADL. Partnership to fight extremism and hate to the financial industry, but does PayPal have ulterior motives, like going after Israeli critics? And then finally, we'll take a look at two technologies that are presence in the financial system, namely fintech and blockchain. Why are there so many startups and investments in Israel in this technology? And why the concentration on payment systems? Recently, there was a team up of two entities that made news, and that relates to how Israeli companies are taking control or influencing, at a minimum, financial tools, in this case, payment system. PayPal Holdings Incorporated, in partnership with ADL, stands for the Anti-Defamation League, announced a new partnership initiative to fight extremism and hate through the financial industry. Now, Israel's control of these types of payment systems, especially in the digital money area, has led to it to target whom it sees as its adversaries, whether in business or politics, like Hamas or Iran.
The Anti-Defamation League is announcing a new partnership with PayPal to defund hate groups.
The dollar-swapping firm PayPal announced a new initiative to track and disrupt payment activity from extremist and hate groups. They would be aided in this effort, they said, by the Anti-Defamation League and a coalition of partner organizations.
From the sounds of it, it appears to be a good initiative, right? But think again. PayPal partnering with ADL to fight extremism and to protect marginalized communities is not all that it appears to be. To combat criminal activity or zoom in on transactions that fund human trafficking or illicit smuggling, like drug smuggling, are all good initiatives. Problem is when the issue takes a political turn. ADL is zooming in on extremists or hate groups, and herein lies the problem. To begin with, hate groups are not illegal. Furthermore, what is the definition that the ADL uses to define this? Well, it doesn't take much investigation to figure this out. ADL, which stands for the Anti-Defamation League, is a leading anti-hate organization that was founded in 1913 in response to an escalating climate of anti-Semitism and bigotry.
ADL, as we've talked about on your show before, is the oldest anti-hate group in the country. And we've been focused on studying extremist individuals, organizations, and movements literally for decades. And our experts in our Center on Extremism are some of the best analysts in the U.S. on understanding groups across the ideological spectrum.
To that end, it serves another entity, Israel. The ADL, therefore, can go after hate groups that don't endorse or agree with Israeli policies, like the Hamas resistance groups or Hezbollah. Can even go further and target countries, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, or other countries that condemn Israeli violation of Palestinians. ADL may even go as far as proposing PayPal to shut down social media accounts of users who engage in what ADL defines as hate and extremism. Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Rodney Martin. He's a political activist, a current affairs analyst. He's also a historian and researcher. Martin is the chairman of the American Nationalist Association. He also hosts a regular radio podcast by the name of World View Conversations. Rodney is also a former U.S. congressional staffer and political candidate, as well as having served in local and state government. Rodney, welcome. Recently, there's this partnership that was announced between PayPal Holdings Incorporated and ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. This partnership initiative to have as its goal fighting extremism and hate through the financial industry. What are your thoughts on this in terms of the way that this partnership has been announced and the goal that it has in front of it?
Well, absolutely, and that's been taking, it first started taking place on the social media platforms, particularly Facebook, and then it spread now into the PayPal, who won't allow PayPal transactions if they disagree with a person's political views. And it's interesting, they have a very subjective view of extremism. You do not see PayPal, Facebook, and social media, these giants, censoring Israeli and Jewish extremism, particularly those that praise the murder of Palestinian and Arab women and children, that advocate pro-war policies and seek to essentially manipulate the American political system, society, and culture. that the manipulation of financial markets and the media has become very easy, as well as censorship, because you now have people who, on one hand, will decry censorship if they say something versus, say, a Republican versus a Democratic Party. But if somebody says something critical of Israel, those same people that are calling for censorship wants those people censored. So it's really a schizophrenic system that has developed in the United States as a result of outside influences by a very, very small minority. Powerful, but powerful.
Okay, well, let's get the thoughts of Allison Weir and introduce her. Allison Weir is the director, or the executive director, of Americans New, a nonprofit organization that focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also the foreign policy of the United States regarding West Asia. Allison, welcome. What are your thoughts on this PayPal and ADL partnership? In some sense, doesn't this pave the way for them to go after what, for example, ADL sees that is suiting its purpose of what constitutes extremism, hate, or whatever it deems to be anti-Israeli, which includes what's posted on social media outlets like Facebook?
I think there's no doubt that this type of thing is used by Israel all the time to target people it dislikes and to take down websites it doesn't want that contains information they dislike. I think that's very clear. The Anti-Defamation League, I feel, is one of the real problems in the United States because this has a very benign reputation. I used to think of it as a good organization because most of us are against defamation, against bigotry, against any kind of unfair racial profiling or prejudice. But it turns out that the Anti-Defamation League is really very largely focused on advocating for Israel. These exaggerated views of Jewish culpability, because all Jewish Americans are not guilty of that. We're talking about individuals.
It's time now for our InfoNews section, where we pick topics old and new that we find important or don't get enough media attention or exposure. Now, what is going on with energy resources? China, this is a topic that we thought was important, has actually ordered energy firms to secure winter fuel supplies, and this is the part that's interesting, at all costs. That means to do whatever it takes to secure fuel supplies. Now, that's going to put further pressure on the price of gas that's paid already by struggling UK energy suppliers, as an example, which is already grappling with power cuts. Now, let's follow this up with that UK energy crisis, which is on the cusp of that, if it's not already, of mammoth proportions. People there may experience an 80% increase in their gas bills. And it's happened already. Energy firm Bulb under fire for monthly bill rises of up to 80%. Now keep in mind that the UK is already plagued by fuel poverty that leads to thousands of deaths during the harsh, cold winter season. Next up, climate crisis. Apple and Disney, if you can believe it, are among companies that are backing groups against the U.S. climate bill. That's right. Amazon and Microsoft are supporting groups fighting legislation to fight climate change. This is despite promises to combat the climate crisis. And of course, as you can see there, that's the budget allocated for that $3.35 trillion. Finally, the chip crisis is not going away, and in particular this for car chips. And what's happened is that it's such a serious problem that car manufacturing in Britain actually fell by 27%. And then Mercedes-Benz also is experiencing problems, warning against possible delay in delivering new cars by at least 1 year.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section where we take a deep look into the topic at hand. Now we're going to take a look at a technology called blockchain and why Israel is a hotspot for that. Now in the past few years, Israel, driven by its military complex and its military industry, has become a hub for startups and innovation, especially with the two technologies that I mentioned, blockchain and fintech. Now blockchain, in case you don't know, is the same technology that is behind the digital currency Bitcoin. You see the money connection? You're going to find out why I'm mentioning that in a few minutes. Now let's move on to another reason for Israeli companies to want to expand in this field. Israeli blockchain companies are after what's called faster settlement times and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, that's very important. Moving on to another reason for its appeal, by establishing a decentralized ledger like for Bitcoin, blockchain technology could facilitate faster payments and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, so obviously you can see the appeal there.
Things that we do as a central bank, our role in the payments industry, the group that I lead, payments department, include establishing policy, kind of long-term policy for the payments landscape in the country, overseeing payment systems, operating payment systems, which are two very different things. We'll get into that in a minute. The payment systems that we operate are RTGS and the National Check Clearinghouse, as well as influencing and partnering with other government agencies and the operations part of the central bank to convert ourselves into a catalyst for adopting digital payments, because as government and as a central bank, we are able to influence consumer behavior deeply. So we take that role seriously as well.
Now, taking a look at fintech, it refers to the integration of technology into offerings by financial services companies. But this is what's important. Fintech expansion by Israel has lured foreign banks to Israel. So you can see that that is paying off again. Looking at the money connection.
Once that customer walked into the shoe store and tried to make a payment with the card, her connection with her bank is with the bank that issued her credit card. The store's connection is with the acquirer that processes the card transactions for the store. But they need to connect. They connect by sending each other data messages, transaction authorization requests, clearing, and then ultimately they also settle funds between them. It is that connection between the payment service providers, this yellow arrow in the middle, which actually comprises the payment system.
And all of this interest for Israeli companies and startups, well, it could it shows how Israel has influence over the financial payment system when it comes to, for example, banks. Now, when you take a look at that, just what I pointed out, this poses this question. Doesn't this give Israel more control or influence over these large financial groups? That is the key question, which obviously is the underlying reason behind Israel's penetration into this market. Occupy Wall Street, OWS. It was an event that took place 10 years ago. Back then, hundreds of protesters took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. They marched toward the financial district and voiced their anger at Wall Street firms and hedge funds that they controlled the U.S.
What kind of power?
People power!
Wall Street, it crashes, and people starve, people lose their jobs, things like that. We're very angry at Wall Street. It's the heart of capitalism, American capitalism especially. That's why we're here today at Wall Street.
The movement would last 59 days, but its ripple effects are still being felt. However, there was another side to the story. The protesters were also angry at the CEOs of some of these conglomerates.
Patricia McAllister, I'm here representing myself, but I do work for the Los Angeles Unified School District. And I think that the Zionist Jews who are running these big banks in our Federal Reserve, which is not run by the federal government, they need to be run out of this country.
These anti-Israeli sentiments were views held by the American and general public for a very long time. Their anger was directed not only at the firms, but also the CEOs. Here are some examples. The general view is that these Wall Street firms and their CEOs, and their greed in particular, were blamed for inequality and political corruption. They were also blasted for the special attention that they received during the 2008 financial crisis. The too big to fail was the government term used for bailing out some of these firms along with their CEOs. U.S. influence, or by some accounts, control over the U.S., is not new news, by Israel, that is. But how does Israel exert control over the U.S., and more importantly, why does the U.S. allow this to happen? Let's take the U.S. Central Bank, or the Fed, as an example. New York Federal Reserve System is the name of the central bank of the U.S. It plays a leadership role in monetary policy, financial supervision, and the payments system of the U.S. By definition, control is exercised only by a board of governors, a member each to be a member of which is a public servant, as they call it, that's appointed to his or her position by the President of the United States and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Well, let's take a look at the appointments of high-ranking officials at the Fed, current and past. You have the current New York Fed Chair, Janet Yellen. You have Ben Bernanke, William Dudley, and Lee Bollinger. They all held top positions at the Fed, from the chairman to vice chairman. All right, rejoining us in this segment is Rodney Martin, and we also have Allison Weir, executive director of If Americans Knew, rejoining us. Rodney, my last question goes to you here. There's a perception about the Fed that is dominated and controlled, influenced somewhat by Israel. Some have even gone as far as saying that the money power that rules the world today, in another respect, is centered at the hands of a few individuals. Are there any truths to these?
Well, there is a probably a more pertinent source, and that came from none other than Meyer Rothschild, who said, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws." So I would, there you have it in and of itself. And of course, the Rothschilds have been a very powerful Jewish banking family for centuries. And as far as the Federal Reserve, one need only look at at least three of the immediate past Federal Reserve chairmen, all of which shared something in common with Meyer Rothschild. And this has created some significant problems within society, particularly in minority communities in the United States, as more and more minorities fall more and more prey to very, very predatory banking practices.
Okay. Well, Allison, one of the things that has always been said and has become obvious is how Israel influences U.S. officials up to the top positions, and that is the U.S. presidents. Again, for Israel to influence decision-making policies by the U.S. president. Even U.S. presidential candidates, when they're running, they need to woo the Israeli vote. Is it a fact that Israel, therefore, can influence the U.S., the White House, or the U.S. president's decision-making?
Well, again, this is a significant fact, but it's a little bit, it's certainly much more nuanced than people might think. There is, I have written about the Israel lobby quite a bit, because my focus is on Israel-Palestine, and it's very important to know what's driving U.S. policies. And I have consistently found that it is the Israel lobby that has driven our policies from the very beginning. And the Israel lobby largely consists of Jewish individuals and organizations. It also consists of others, but I'd say that's the group that dominates the Israel lobby.
Okay, we appreciate that. That is Allison Weather, Executive Director of If Americans Knew. Well, the point that Allison made there about the Israeli lobby is very significant. The Israeli lobby that she's talking about is very dominant, and what she is referring to there is AIPAC. And in particular, what is prevalent there is that U.S. lawmakers have to actually pledge their allegiance to Israel with conditions attached, as you're about to see.
Next up, a look at one of the most influential families in the world, namely the Rothschilds. They have been behind many investments during their time, which is a window into how they exerted their power and influence in different business sectors. But what better way to tell you about this family than to introduce our new addition to the ED family, Matthew.
Our focus here is a family called the Rothschilds, a familiar name to many people. They are a wealthy family originally from Germany. They have been accused of secretly controlling the world economy and profiting from wars. The Rothschilds were the dominant power in European investment banking, which controlled 50% of the world's wealth. In 1823, it was reported that they took control over the financial operations of the Catholic Church worldwide. Through J.P. Morgan, among others, the Rothschilds took control of the banking industry in New York and therefore the U.S. Some of the other investments are Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company, Edward Harriman Railroad Empire, and Andrew Carnegie's Steel Empire. Rothschild's banks were also known to finance railway systems around the world. They financed the construction of the Suez Canal in Egypt, and they provided the capital for De Beers in 1888, which is the largest diamond mining company in the world. In 1987, Edmond de Rothschild created the World Conservation Bank to gain control of land in third world countries. The bank assumes the debts of these countries in exchange for real estate that is conveyed to the bank. In 1913, the Rothschilds established their last and current central bank in America, the Federal Reserve Bank. This independent bank regulates and controls America's money supply and monetary policies. Talking about central banks, it's interesting to note here that by 2001, only seven nations in the world, including China, Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, and Libya, did not have Rothschild-controlled central banks. By 1995, the Rothschilds controlled an estimated 80% of the world's uranium reserves, thereby giving the family a monopoly over the nuclear power. The modern-day Rothschilds family, however, is said not to have the same wealth and influence as before. One reason is that they have produced hundreds of descendants and there is no longer any centralized family wealth. However, they are known as the wealthiest family in history to have a collective net worth of $400 billion as of 2021. Please send us your comments. We do appreciate them.
The partnership between ADL and PayPal. Yes, there are good incentives there. I mean, ADL claims it is after cutting off the hands, the financial hands of extremist groups and hate, at least in their eyes. That is a good thing, but here's where the double standard is. If that is their aim, then what about the money that Israel has sent to assassins who have assassinated people in other countries, like in multiple cases of Iranian nuclear scientists? Or what about money that is sent to Israel from the U.S. to expand settlement activities, which the U.S. classifies as charity money sent to Israel? Now, these are acts that are clearly against international law. Where is PayPal and ADL there? Something to think about, isn't it? That is for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikhail Vitali and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.